Horticulturalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com talking to Gib Strange. So I know you wanted structure today, and I feel particularly unstructured. Like I think it's partly because I've been working on a completely unrelated piece, which I probably shouldn't even say what it is because we might get pulled into it. But it's about Hollywood more than anything.
Well, I was thinking we could talk about Neurodeviant. Does that jive with?
Good idea. Yeah. I mean, that was the point of having these meetings, talk through right. That, but also now Notes from Underground, Notes from Uncanny Valley. Have you read Notes from Underground, by the way?
Yes.
Was it did it influence you?
No, not really.
Thinking I see the influences, but it just occurred to me that it's such a prototypical work, I think.
Yeah, certainly I wasn't thinking about it when I was writing it, except in the sense of like that kind of outsider archetype that became common in literature.
Yeah.
Later in Camus too. I mean, I read Notes from the Underground when I was a teenager, and I guess I'm just saying I wasn't consciously aware of any, I wasn't beyond that, you know, but but I like kind of playing off of that with the title.
So that was conscious.
Yeah. Yeah. Replacing the Underground with the Uncanny Valley.
Right. Yeah, well, Poincaré described Taxi Driver as a raw tabloid version of Notes from Underground. So there's a lineage, you could say, between, well, a whole bunch of different works. As you say, Camus, The Outsider, which I probably read it before Notes from Underground, almost certainly, actually, because I got into Dostoevsky in my very early 20s, and I read Camus when I was still a teenager. I was about 18, 19. Mm. Of course, I saw Taxi Driver long before that when I was 15 or something. I'd say it's been a very, very central, that archetype, if you like, of the unsympathetic, alienated outsider.
Right.
And of course, you could say that not Neurodeviant as a book, but the idea of the Neurodeviant at least is kind of the latest iteration of that. I mean, the autist was the alienated, unsympathetic outsider.
You say unsympathetic, is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, not to me, obviously, that's the whole point.
Right, it seems it's only sympathetic to other alienated, unsympathetic outsiders, which there seems to be more and more of, right?
Yeah, which presents a bit of a paradox there, which feels like there's something paradoxical about works of art that become popular depicting the unsympathetic, alienated outsider, because that's sort of paradoxical, because like Travis Bickle is hugely popular. He can't get laid and he can't make friends, but he's an icon, you know, to millions of people.
Sure.
So what is that? It's like when the culture takes something and I could say exploits it, but anyway, it packages it in such a way that it actually becomes appealing and sympathetic. So if it wasn't sympathetic, nobody would appreciate the work. But I mean, my subconscious, the attraction or the appeal of those works that became conscious to me very early on was the way that art can make the unsympathetic sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess Frank Booth in Blue Velvet was, to me, that was like the apotheosis of that, because he's not meant to be sympathetic, really. He's the heavy. He's no longer the central figure. He's actually the adverse figure. Mm-hmm. But he's very sympathetic, I found. I found myself loving Frank Booth.
An anti-villain.
Yeah.
What is it, do you think? That's an interesting example to go into. Where do you feel the most sympathy with him? Because it's sort of Kyle MacLachlan's connection to him. It seems like it's the moment where, what's Kyle MacLachlan's name?
Jeffrey
sees Frank in himself. That connection happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where, is that kind of the key to, I think maybe when you see him crying in the club when he's watching her sing.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Yeah, right. That's kind of the moment where.
I think once the correlation becomes clear between his savagery and his pathology and his suffering, I quoted in Blood Poets, I was just rereading my thing on Blue Velvet, and I quoted Mary Shelley, the monster saying, "Misery made me a fiend, make me happy and I'll be virtuous." That's very clear with Frank, is that he's only as dangerous and as vicious as he is, you know, miserable.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's hard not to see all of his violence, his brutality as expressions of misery.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're very profound and shocking, so therefore it communicates how much he's suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this came up because I was talking about the scene in my book where I call the narrator, it's a third person, maybe that's associative, where he's asked to take a couple's photograph, and I had it originally written where it occurs to him to run off with the camera, and that Darren Westland, I think, just thought, maybe at that moment, he kind of came off like an asshole. And then we kind of had this idea about sympathetic. And I also have this vague memory of Gary Height talking about it in your podcast, about the idea of in existential literature of that archetype. And I think he was kind of, I mean, it's vague, but I can't remember quite, but something that, about, existentialism being like the big product of the 20th century, and that outsider figure kind of being sold to in the culture.
Mm. Right. Well, I don't remember that conversation. It'd be interesting to hear it back, but yeah, that was what I was. That was the same idea that I was bringing up just a moment ago, the sort of paradox of the contradiction of that. Why would a culture raise up a figure that is antithetical to its, its values in that way? Because it's controlled opposition.
Mm-hmm.
But bringing it back to the specifics, your third person avatar of yourself, your fictional version of yourself. And I think it's good for a writer to remain ambiguous about that to some degree without mystifying or anything. And it does become, like I've written, fictionalized versions of my life to the point that there are areas where I'm not sure now, because I definitely did try and do this. I added elements, like I added me meeting Clint Eastwood in Carmel while I was traveling, as part of, you know, a fictionalized autobiography. And I didn't end up wondering, did I actually meet Clint Eastwood? But it did become quite real to me, that scene, that where I would almost felt like I had a memory of it. And there were certainly other things that I have made up and I'm no longer sure. Smaller, more minor things, like, did I actually embellish that feat, that detail, or was that real? So there is something inevitable, I think, about what you're doing with Notes from Uncanny Valley, which is your narrativizing your experiences. But anyway, that was all just a really kind of a preamble, because I wanted to ask about the specifics with that scene and the tourists and the camera. The desire to run away with the camera, well, how was that an accurate representation as you remember it now, or was that an embellishment?
Yeah, it was, and I think they just to be clear, like, the idea was not to sell the camera later for money, but to look at their pictures that are already on the camera, you know.
Yeah,
that was the incentive, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that was in there. I certainly don't remember ever having the impression that you just wanted to steal. It was
more about voyeurism than than
crime, yeah, or just being aggressive even. But wasn't it also about, do you know the Edgar Allan Poe story called The Imp of the Perverse?
No, I don't think so.
So that's about how there's something in us that desires to act in inverse ratio to how rational the action is. As in, we have an idea and we know that this is a bad idea, and precisely because we know it's a bad idea, something in us wants to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a word that kept coming up when I was working on the summary copy thing, perverse, you know. Yeah, so what do you think that's about?
Well, I think what's coming to mind now, and it's been a while since I thought about the story, and it's something that I have been aware of in myself for a long time. The most obvious example is on a bridge or a train platform, thinking, wanting to jump in front of the train, not because I want to get killed, but just because I don't want to, right? There's something comes up, and then the resistance to it makes it stronger, right? Because it's like, don't think about hippopotamuses. Well, that makes you think about hippopotamuses. So I've always been aware of that, but I'm wondering now how much it relates to the whole thing of taboo and social control, and how, you know, when you create a taboo, you also create a corresponding desire in people to break it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it's, well, because of this tension between being part of a collective and wanting to be separate from it and be an individual. So we reconcile that tension because we have to be both separate and part of it. We reconcile it by defining ourselves against the collective in some way. Like mm-hmm. the negative identities. That way we're both part of it and not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's taboo breaking as well. And that would relate to the outsider also.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree anyway.
Monoculture versus diversity.
Yeah, it's right. So this thing of monoculture as well, and how that's become, because that wasn't, that's a recent thing. It's becoming more and more homogenize the culture, so presumably the desire to be an individual is becoming stronger and stronger as well, which seems to be true with transgender and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all perverse in that regard, which is why figures like Travis or Notes from Underground or your protagonist or even Frank Booth are sympathetic, I think, because I forgot actually why I was going to say they were, funnily enough, but anyway, that's why. Whatever I said before is why.
Yeah, well, like in that example of that scene where he's taking a picture of the couple, you know, he's single, right? Like, so you know, he's alone. Yeah. So there's, you have to have sympathy for, you know, everybody knows what it's like to be single and to be taking a picture of a couple in some sense, right?
True. But I think it relates to a kind of awareness. I think what I was groping towards there was this, that the adversarial figure is aware of something that the non-adversarial figure isn't. Mm. I mean, that's certainly what makes these characters appealing, is that they're, it's not that they're too good to join society, but they're too, well, it depends actually, and because they vary a lot. Certainly they're too damaged, but I think because they're damaged, they're also too aware of something, of the hypocritical nature of society.
Yeah, they know something the couple doesn't, or...
And you could even say that what makes the society hypocritical is it that it doesn't hold a space for its damaged.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, yeah. Doesn't really have space for the individual, period.
No. No, so that's, I guess that's what I mean. They're aware of the paradox and the hypocrisy of society, which is saying be an individual in order to be part of this society. Yeah, we'll embrace you as an individual if you conform. So that's an inherent lie and a paradox.
Makes me think of... I'm gonna be different, like all my different friends. There's sort of a marketed, you know, there's like socially acceptable forms of rebellion, right? That's a big part of the youth culture always, you know.
Yeah, well, and that brings back to the controlled opposition, doesn't it? Because I mean, there's always going to be individuals who are closer to being individuals, and so they won't swallow the hypocrisy, they won't fall for it, and they won't conform and be different in the ways that are, you know, being marketed to them. And so for them, you have to create a rebellion. The culture has to create a rebellion.
Yeah. What does that look like? What would be a good example?
Well, like the counterculture. Like the counterculture as PSYOP, that whole thing.
Right.
Like those were all dropouts, and they're probably, a lot of them were genuinely seeing the hypocrisy of society and genuinely trying to follow their own orientation, but they also, social animals, they also needed to be part, feel like they were part of something. So they were easy prey for a, you know, a state created counterfeit. So then, I mean, the kind of works we're talking about that were raised up by the culture, presumably there was something in them that was useful to the culture. I mean, actually, the really obvious example we're not using here is Salinger, The Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was massive influential, and that was about that character as well, the alienated outsider.
Yeah, kind of the ultimate. I mean, Holden Caulfield, we all know that name more so than any of the previous outsider figures, right?
I think it's particularly US. Like, I didn't grow up being aware of Holden Caulfield.
Yeah, it's sort of a rite of passage in America to turn 16 and read Catcher in the Rye.
Right. So yeah, that's got to be something. Got to be something powerful behind that. I'd say beside the zeitgeist, or at least the zeitgeist is not what we think it is, as in just this wholly organic thing, like nature.
We met up in South America, where I knew our murders would go unsolved, if not entirely unnoticed. Tales told by dead men are always worth hearing, so let's start from the beginning.
I got it straight from the source. Went in bed on the wrong horse. Called me up for a couple of bucks. Last time he loaned money, he went and bought a Mexican divorce.
To the meta, which is you and I writing, trying to find the bridge between fiction and non-fiction, or the synthesis of the two perhaps, and at the same time and even in the same sort of breath, or this with the same, it's the same agenda in a way, to reach an audience, you know, to even find a publisher at this point. So I find many publishers, it's whatever, let's just say currently, you know, the things we're working on are difficult to even place, much less reach an audience. So then it's like, is there a way to make our expression of the alienated, unsympathetic outsider within us, to speak for that part and to communicate what it sees, is there a way to make it communicable to loads of people? Mm. And if so, would that invalidate it? And then, so, you know, is it really desirable? I suppose is the question. Right?
Because success equals failure, could equal failure.
Yeah, if we want to reach the people who really will receive it, they would be people who really are outsiders. So then they wouldn't be reachable through the usual channels, and in fact, they would even perhaps distrust something that was successful.
That's true. Yeah, right. Well, that's like when you're young and it's the, you know, the band that gets really big, but you were into them first, and
yeah,
it becomes difficult to trust them. I mean, that usually happens because then their material is less relatable because their experience of life is different than yours because they're now famous and rich.
Yeah, and getting laid constantly.
Right. But let's figure out just the first half of the question of if you could even, how did you put market to, if you could even
reach a more large audience.
Right. As I was thinking, I mean, we had a culture and then we had a counterculture, so it bifurcated in the 60s. And then from there, you know, a certain amount of the counterculture was just absorbed back into the culture. I was thinking about like Mad Men, where you had, you know, you could kind of, you got to like kind of, I feel like a lot of big part of the fascination with that show, I was late to the game with it, was seeing the inner workings of getting inside the mind of people who get inside the minds of the people, you know, in advertising, which is kind of what we're talking about, right? Like, 'cause we're talking about how do you find a publisher and how do you sell it to the publisher first, market and all this. But anyway, like the counterculture, a part of it also continued to just bifurcate, right? And like I have that part in my book where talking about, you know, like in the 90s, cable, you had like, you know, 300 channels. So advertising was happening on a more individual level. And in a way that like the remote control was the precursor to the computer mouse, right? Because that would lead to an even more individually targeted market. I mean, right down to your individual tastes where your feed is completely self-curated and advertisers, you know, the level of diversity at that point where everybody has a very specific personal taste that can be catered to.
By corporations who mass produce.
Right.
There's a paradox in that too.
Corporations who mass produce, but must be trying to understand. I mean, you can break them down into smaller and smaller sub-demographics, but, you know, like you said, you've got the transgender and, you know, a lot of the neurodiversity. And so there's more of a wider array, you know, variety of, you can't just point to like the middle-aged housewife demographic the way the 50s or 60s, you know. And especially because youth culture is something that is so targeted, because that's where people are forming their sense of identity. And are have more time because they're not working all the time. They're not adults yet, and they have some income that they can, or they have some money, maybe their parents' money to spend. So
yeah, so it's like the culture is replicating, or the counterculture, whatever. Like you said, increased bifurcation. So there's more and more subdivisions now.
Right.
Whereas before, if you imagine in the 50s, there was such this oppressive stereotype that was supposed to be one size fits all practically. Even if you're homosexual, you couldn't, you know, like even something as basic as that, as a deviation as that, and you were outside the, you know, the club. So then there would have been this wilderness in which people really had to just find their own, you know, orientation, so to speak, culturally, socially, sexually, you name it, relative freedom as compared to now, where no matter how specific your deviations are, there's probably already a market been carved out for it.
Yeah, right. And on, you know, like the level of sexuality, the what sexual behaviors that would have been repressed 30 years ago are now there's quite a vast fetish menu to sort of appropriate your sense of sexual identity from, you know, via porno and
online dating and So I mean, this is kind of a departure. It's right after what you just said, but we're going in an unexpected direction now, because recently I mean after I got back from Finland, because of things that went on in the retreat partially, I felt like I wanted to take a new departure in terms of my, you know, communications and whatnot, my output, and that I wanted it to center around maternal psychic enmeshment, as I call it, mother bondage. You call it mother bondage. As soon as you search for that online, all you get is pornographic images, which is kind of the point that I'm getting to. But anyway, I had this thought, and this is a thought I've had some years back. I was thinking about a book I could write called The End of Sex, Everything You Wanted to Know About Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask, it being the subject of maternal psychic enmeshment and how it hijacks our libido and prevents us from actually having a healthy sexual relationship with a woman. It's a particularly male thing. Anyway, so I was thinking that I felt confident enough in my own life now to share some of my experience around this, because it's pretty extensive. And the reason I'm bringing it up now is that with all these little niche and subcategories and all the rest of it, this is not something that's being talked about. This isn't something that's being offered to people. It's, you know, some sort of orientation around what happens when you're psychically enmeshed with your mother in ways that aren't obvious, like Norman Bates or flaming homosexuals, but still to the point that you can't sustain or even enter into a sexual relationship with a woman. Like, this is so prevalent now, in my opinion, and yet it's not, there's nothing out there. Google is not going to give you an algorithm for this. It's not going to, there's going to be no ads popping up. The opposite, right? This is something that's a closely guarded secret, you could say, and yet is of massive relevance to, well, yeah, millions of men.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was kind of, it was interesting. It just came up organically with what you were talking about, because here's an example of something that could be widely successful in theory, and that wouldn't be invalidating it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because then you're pointing to a way to gauge whether or not the success of success being successful or something, you know, that's not where it wouldn't render it. Suspect, or, you know.
It would almost be the reverse, because it would be a way to test out how correct that particular diagnosis is, based on how much people responded to it. Of course, there is the problem that people don't want to think about it or recognize it, much less admit to it. So it wouldn't. Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I guess we could say that that has been tested out on the other side, right? Could we say that there are examples of culture that I mean, it's probably not going to be an accurate equivalent to what your project is, but for something where women are allowed to examine their daddy issues. I'm just thinking men are more uncomfortable with going there than...
They certainly are, yeah, yeah. I don't think it's that widespread, women acknowledging father issues or... I mean, obviously the whole Freudian, you know, subculture or the, you know, pop psychology is, yeah, it's come and gone and come back again. It's definitely part of our culture. Yeah.
But isn't, like... Through scrolling through countless online dating profiles, I've noticed that the amount of women advertising submissive and seeking dominant, it seems like the bedroom has become this safe space for exploring power, working out trauma and I mean, isn't that what that whole book, 50 Shades of Rape, is about?
Well, I think it's, yeah, it's a good counterpoint, because that's, it's very debatable about whether anyone's working out their trauma that way.
Like right, or just indulging in their...
Yes, exactly. It's a paraphilia that is sourced in trauma, and if you enjoy your paraphilia, then you just want to enjoy it. You just want to find circumstances that feed it and that justify it at the same time. So, but of course, that could lead to a healing, because one has the opportunity to see the roots of something if one is going deep into it. But I'd say, in most cases, it doesn't, and it's more likely to backfire than not. And this is speaking personally, as like I did consciously try and explore my trauma in a safe space of the bedroom, and it backfired horribly. Mm-mm. So, I mean, that's something I could testify to at some point. This is an area in my life that I have kept. You know, people think that I lay it all out, but I don't. I keep a lot of stuff private because I consider it private, and that's specifically around my sex life. Although I will refer to it, and I make no secret that it's fraught, and you know, occasionally a desert. But beyond that, you know, I don't, obviously don't, because it involves someone else primarily, not because I'm embarrassed about it per se. You know, this does intersect with neurodeviance as well. Like by the time it gets to the Kubrickon, which is, you know, two books later, but presumably it's in there already. Maybe it's in the first book that you read, I'm not sure. Certainly the notion of psychic enmeshment in the mother, which was in our very first conversation, Big Mother, is central to the whole AI project. Mm-hmm. Like, and also my conversation with Dave, where I said, oh, we're trying to recreate the mother's body.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you get, you've got to get that bit in about plugging in the umbilical cord, and you got to get that in the book.
Yeah, well, it's not just a question of sticking it in somewhere, is it? No pun intended, but of extrapolating more from that, because that was just an idea I had while I was talking to Dave, and he didn't go there, so it didn't go anywhere. So it's kind of,
well, it fits in really well with the Big Mother idea you had, and like I said, why are Siri and Alexa female? You know,
The voices. Yeah, and Her, that movie, Her. Mm-hmm. That's a textbook, whatever, text to study. I dislike the movie, though. I wouldn't want to have to see it again.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, so, I mean, I haven't exactly finished KubeCon. I certainly haven't finished NeuroDeviant, if that's what it's called, the whole thing. And that would be the end of KubeCon unless I have a fourth book. But where it ends so far, the point it's up to now in the third book, the KubeCon is about how the Overlook is the mother's psyche, and Wendy is actually the Overlook in The Shining, that they're the same, essentially.
Go ahead. And
hence the ending of The Shining shows Danny returning to the mother's psychic, the psychic womb of the mother, when, as the, you know, the father is left in the cold, and Danny remains enmeshed with the mother's psyche, and which is the Overlook. Like, the Overlook still has them, and the Overlook is like the mainframe for AI, as in it's this structure that is there to siphon off Danny's psychic energy and to animate itself. So that whole metaphor is central to the whole book, I think, and how it creates and then harvests or exploits neurodeviants to do it. Like, the culture creates the neurodeviants, like in a Philip K. Dick story, to siphon off their energy.
In which Philip K. Dick story?
Well, I was in Minority Report, but that's not exactly, they're not batteries in the Matrix, are they? But there's also the, is it Time Out of Joint? Is it Regal Gum, the one where he's, this is the precursor to the Truman Show, where they, they just create that whole surrogate reality for him so that they can tap into his psychic powers and avert nuclear war. There's that one. And then there's Dick's titles are annoying in that way, because they sort of, they don't stick in memory, and they're easy to confuse.
Yeah, and some of them aren't that good, like Martian Time Slip.
Okay, so it was Time Out of Joint. Martian Time Slip is with the autist boy who sucks people into these false realities or subjective realities. So Martian Time Slip, out of Joint, you splice them together, and you've got quite a lot there thematically, and then throw Minority Report in for good measure. But anyway, so this idea that the culture, need, like the Matrix, it needs psychic energy of the individuals that inhabit it to maintain itself, and in order to do that, it has to traumatize them.
Yeah, like it has to create a a mechanism for control that has to be based on like a psychic enmeshment with mother.
Right.
It doesn't have to be, I suppose, but it is. And
well, I think because of course we're getting full circle here. At the end, they're plugged in like fetuses into the Matrix, and at the beginning, they're never unplugged from their mother's psyche. You know, although they leave the physical womb, they don't leave the psychic womb. And I think it has to, because the human being is created out of the mother's body as an extension of the mother's body. So that's its primary reality. Mm-hmm. So then any kind of trauma is going to, the point of the trauma is to prevent autonomy or individuation, and if a human being doesn't become autonomous, then it's going to remain an extension of its mother's psyche, because that's all it is before, that's all we are before we become individuals, unless you're going to get metaphysical.
Before birth.
I was a boy in the girl's bathroom when I met you. Pushed me to the mirror, and you pulled me through. Mr. Popular, it was pitch dark in the bedroom, except for the glowing lights
of a dozen cigarette cherries. Well, it looks like I'm Mr. Popular tonight. Mr. Popular. Mr. Popular, who the fuck are you? And Mr. Popular makes the scene, he always makes a scene. He's dressed in a grin, but it's wearing thin. Mr. Popular, if anyone asks, Mr. Popular.
Yeah, and I think we could learn a lot. I mean, it could be useful to juxtapose your notes from Uncanny Valley with Neurodeviant as you read it, because yours is a relatively, you know, small scale project that's a personal narrative, first person narrative, testimony of an individual living in this derealized matrix culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the sort of the soft plot that I either discovered or projected onto it, or a bit of both, of is consistent with this, as in your character doesn't know if he's living in a matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Simulated reality, and wants to test it because that's how it feels. He feels derealized, and over time discovers that he's actually it's not the world that's unreal, it's him.
Yeah, right. I'm the simulation.
Sorry?
I'm the simulation.
Yeah, well, you could be a physical real, but you're not a human being, whatever. I mean, however it plays out, I mean, of course, if this is something that people don't really get to this point. I don't know if Elon Musk does. If reality were a simulation, then of course we would be simulations too.
Right.
There's no reason to presume that we've got real selves outside the simulation. We could just be code.
Mm-hmm.
Just part of the simulation that's programmed to have thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't generally go there. It's like, if this is a simulation, then we need to get out.
Well, if you go there, where do you go from there? Because you either accept that there's not, that the value that you had previously placed on the genuine and the authentic is no longer valid, or you end up in the psych ward, you know. What do you do with
the simulated psych ward?
Right.
Yeah, what do you do if you realize that your thoughts that you might be fake, or that the world is fake, are themselves fake? It cancels itself out, which I think is right and good. The whole question of am I real? It's a bit like the statement, life is meaningless. It's a meaningless statement. One can only say that life is meaningful. That's the only statement one can say about this that is meaningful. Because if life is meaningful, then the statement, life is meaningful, is meaningful. But if life is meaningless, then the statement life is meaningless becomes meaningless too. So, so it counts itself out. So it's a bit like that. We acknowledge that if we believe that we're an unreal simulation in an unreal simulation, well, compared to what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's also like, yeah, I feel like a lot of people operate under the statement of bring your own meaning, you know?
Like, yeah.
Come to life, bring your own meaning.
Yeah, that's what it seems to be a shoe-in for. It's not that, it's just that instead of acknowledging some real meaning, what I like and what I prefer is going to be the measure of real.
Right, right. Yeah, and then we get back into that subjective, you know, inability to know anybody else's, to get inside anybody else's head, where, you know, in Neurodeviant, you talk a lot about people's perception, one's individual perception varying from individual to individual, but you know, you also have to factor in ideology and, you know, that I guess that would be part of socialization and kind of what everybody's programmed to see or not see in reality. Also, like when we were talking about where do you go from there of realizing that you're a simulation, I feel like that also opens the door to nihilism. Could open that door, and that's something we've talked about a lot. I sort of agree with the idea that nihilism is actually just kind of this defense mechanism, this coping mechanism for living in an unreal world. I guess I'm saying, well, nihilism, you know, where do you go from there? You know, like, where
from that? Well, because I got a lived example of that with my brother, who's
leads to death. It leads to
self-destruction. Yeah, I mean, I think it has to.
So, or, go ahead.
Well, because I mean, so my brother, he was much more conscious than most nihilists, and he, in a certain sense, he wasn't a nihilist. Maybe that's why he self-destroyed, you know, physically rather than in some more subtle way. But he would announce, you know, I passionately believe in nothing. He would put it that way, as in his nihilism wasn't that he didn't believe in anything, it was that he believed in nothing, like capital N.
But he still believed. The word believe is in there.
Yeah. That's my point, yeah. So that we have to believe. Mm-hmm. In order to act, we have to believe. And like we're sort of talking around now, I keep coming back to the whole question of meaning demands that there is meaning. Like if you question meaning, you're acknowledging that there is meaning, because the only context within which to question whether something's meaningful or not is meaning. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole context for asking questions is meaning. I mean, nothing, there's nothing without meaning. So then nihilism is like, it starts out as trying to negate meaning, but because you can't, it's the nature abhors a vacuum thing, because you can't negate meaning without mm-hmm. negating yourself, without negating consciousness itself, then you assign all meaning to nothing, to a negation. Mm-hmm. What becomes meaningful is to negate meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it definitely feels like we're moving out of the era of nihilism, it feels like, right? Because that was very much a 20th century thing. And now, and you could even just say that simulation theory, it's a religion that works for science, right? You know, it's a religion that makes sense for science.
How does it make sense?
In that it's there are like rules of evidence that can be that the scientific method could kind of be applied.
So this is back to notes again then. It's like if your character sets out to prove,
to test it, yeah,
that he's in a simulation, he ends up by negating himself.
Uh-oh.
I mean, it's quite tidy as a formula. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't literally destroy himself. It's based on you. But he might reach the point where he has some kind of breakdown or breakthrough because of having to see something about himself, which is he's not who he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like within the context of a scientific mindset or even culture, just say the culture that we're in, which, and this is where I'd say that nihilism hasn't phased out, it's transmuted into super egoism maybe. But if you negate everything else, then all that you're left with is your own power to negate, which is the ego. And then that becomes king. So, but what was I about to say about notes, about your character? Within the culture, within the context of the culture, if he's not willing to believe in the culture, the simulation, and let it tell him who he is, to quote the Matrix again, then he ends up being a void, like a replicant who just recognizes, oh, I was just created by culture to, yeah, you know, to imbibe the culture and fuel the culture, and that's unreal. So then he'd have this crisis of seeing himself as a replicant or a zombie or a bit of both.
I'm trying to think because, you know, it's interesting because you responded so much more to the action pieces than the think pieces in the book.
Yeah.
We're saying action pieces meaning...
Not a vehicle for Bruce Willis.
you know, interactions with people and daily encounters and life. But I'm thinking about that because I'm thinking, well, in the book, the evidence that he is a replicant, if you like, that the evidence that he collects, it's mostly based on that he decides that the symptoms of depersonalization that he's experiencing could be glitches in his programming, right? he's supposed to have a human experience and human memories, but because it never quite feels real or right to him, that could, you know, it's like there's a problem with the manufacturing, you know, right? There's a problem with you know you're watching a movie if there are scratches on the film, or, you know, it's the flaws and imperfections, right? Which is also like, people say it's our imperfections that make us human. So, but where was I going? I'm trying to think of, is there a type of evidence that could be based less on like a philosophical search or journey and more on action-based evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Philip K. Dick, I think that didn't he write an early story where a person, I think maybe opens their chest or something and discovers there's a tape, a reel-to-reel machine that's you know, dictating the pre-programmed path that that individual is on, you know?
Right. Well, you're operating at a much subtler level, and you don't
right.
you don't actually want to fictionalize. I mean, whatever, you're prepared to, but you, if you're going to do it, it has to be organic. You don't want to just start introducing science fiction tropes in there, or,
yeah.
you know, going into melodrama. You want it to still be on consistent with the tone and the style of it so far. So it would be, even if you do fictionalize it, would be in subtle ways, I imagine. And I mean, I think that just about every interaction that you write in there, and I assume that this is conscious to some degree, is illustrating something specific. Yeah, something is off in this character's ability to interact with other human beings.
Right. And vice versa, often, you know, there's something wrong with the world, you know.
Yeah, it's not either or, for sure. So it wouldn't have to be, you know, I laid out that plot line in a, to make it simple as a single line, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be as straightforward as an either or thing. He could realize he's a replicant simultaneously with realizing that he's surrounded by replicants. He doesn't have to be the only one by any means.
Yeah.
That would still make it a different kind of simulation than initially he was thinking. But yeah, I just think there's, I think it's already there in many of the encounters, in that they do seem to be little blueprints of mm-hmm. almost like philosophical blueprints.
Yeah, for some reason I'm instinctively thinking of a particular piece as you said, there's, you know, I like the challenge of this idea of, in the last section of the book, trying to link that internal monologue more with the action pieces, somehow merge the thought pieces and the action pieces in a better way. And I thought about it literally with the example of, I wrote about a couple experiences, you know, when you're walking down the street and there's a street person, a homeless person who is maybe schizophrenic, but they're talking and they start saying things that have some direct connection to what you were just thinking or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess that's almost a little too easy, but it's also like, the way I have written about it already, it's almost just implying, yeah, what does that imply? What is that evidence of? And, you know, the first thing that you think is that there's some sort of radio signal happening, some kind of collective unconscious that person has an antenna for, you know?
Don't try for a felony. Popular in the leper colony, just can't hold a good man back. 12,000 roses, daffodils, just striking poses to compliment malevolent quips. Says the headstone, get off my fool ships. holes in my shoes. He sent someone I've never seen. He says it's running keeps him lean. He walks the wide avenues like it's the alleys of Beirut. He says he writes for magazines, doesn't care what it is you believe. He looks behind him on the streets, avoids the manholes with his feet. He stays in public when we meet. Says he'll soon be off for good. Remember me, it's your old friend. He says he can't quite remember when. Was it in Laos or was it in perhaps Tuileries? Yes, Les Jardins. He wears a white linen suit, and I've got holes in my shoes. He sent someone I've never seen. He says it's running keeps him lean.
Well, what about, have you considered the possibility that, like your neighbor, that you might be under psychotronic manipulation or attack?
Yeah, well, or in, I don't know if I looked at it as attack, but like a, definitely like that there was a pre-programmed path that I was being guided along, right? But that, you know, what does that mean? That's, you know, it's like you thinking you were the one, like you said, it's actually quite a mundane delusion, right? Like, you know, and the Truman Show delusion, it's almost cookie cutter made for a culture that where everybody's narcissistic anyway, everybody's.
Mm. Well, it makes it more interesting and relevant to write about though, because it's like fish and water, like most people are suffering these delusions and they don't even know it because the culture is selling those delusions to them. So all their friends are also delusional in their own particular ways, which is similar enough to their delusion for them not to have to question it. So it's back to the alienated outsider, isn't it? It's just the theme there, and even with Travis in Taxi Driver, because he keeps a journal, is somebody who's having a dialogue with themselves. Right. And so they're actually, as fucked up as they might be, it's more reliable what they're telling themselves than listening to the culture.
Right.
Even to the extent maybe that they're seeing how fucked up their internal dialogue is, because that's, the culture has given them the dialogue. That's why I think it's an interesting area that you could explore without overtly fictionalizing, because you might be receiving radio waves into your skull. How do you know you're not? You know, I mean, maybe we all are. It's a 5G thing as well. It's now pretty topical.
Oh yeah, Darren was talking about that. I haven't looked into it much.
I haven't looked into it much, but I'm already paranoid, so I don't need to. I mean, really.
Yeah.
I already believe this stuff is going on, so.
How about this Paul Hellyer? How about that guy, huh?
Is he the Canadian guy who's saying the Illuminati? Yeah. I just, weird, because I was just copying and pasting about him into my current piece when we started this conversation, literally. So I just heard about him through, because I happen to be researching the Illuminati now, not as a secret conspiracy, but as a meme. You know how they have their own website now. I should say they. There is a website that claims to be the official Illuminati website, and it's verified by Twitter and blah blah blah.
20 years ago it was a conspiracy, now it's a meme. I mean, it could be both, but it's certainly, you know, it's almost like when something becomes the simulacra and whatever it was originally isn't there anymore, and then you can only interact with the simulacrum, you know. Like when people talk about the Illuminati, what are they talking about? It was already so obfuscated to begin with, you know.
Yeah, well, that's right. What are they talking about? They don't know. And even if we look into it, we don't necessarily know. I don't know, obviously, what that website is. I don't know what Robert Anton Wilson was doing, whether he was Discordian Society was a CIA front, which Tim Garrison believed, I just found out. So yeah, it's looking more and more like the Illuminati meme was a psyop from day one. Well, not the historical part, but the cultural aspect. Well, the historical part was too, I suppose. But I mean, the current meme doesn't go back really to Bavaria and Adam Weishaupt have. It goes back more to Wilson and Shea and the Illuminatus thing, right? So that, yeah, so now it seems it's gone all the way into reality to the point that politicians are now, or ex-politicians are now expostulating it. Hollywood, like Madonna, is claiming to know the real Illuminati and so on. But you can't always tell whether something online is a fabricated fake news article or not.
Well, yeah, because it's, you know, and then they talk about unreliable sources, you know. I think that Paul Hellyer guy, I mean, he's been talking about aliens for a long time now. You know?
Yes.
I mean, his political career is long over, so.
Yeah, it's true. It doesn't really give him much credential, the fact that he was a politician, I suppose. I mean, not that that would make somebody reliable as a source of information, obviously, on the contrary, but just that more and more seemingly mainstream characters are expostulating about the Illuminati, and that the whole thing has gone mainstream now. But in such a way, that's usually the case with these psyops, that it's not becoming more credible. It's coming mainstream without becoming more credible. In fact, it's becoming less credible in a weird way.
Yeah, right. Well, a lot of these things are sort of being turned into jokes. But then we have to figure out, like, or we have to question or look for, you know, it's like if you have this giggle cover story where it's the Brave New World approach rather than the 1984 approach, where, in other words, instead of withholding information, you're just going to just put a lot of it, way too much information, so that you're just, you know, you could never find the signal in that deluge of noise. And that it become kind of a cultural joke and a meme. What does that discredit? What is the thing that, what's the thing that's there? What is it? You know, what's the thing being discredited?
Well, I know what I think it is. What do you think it is?
You first, and I'll just.
Well, I think it's
a control mechanism.
Well, okay, there's that, but I think it's complicity with crimes. With crimes of, you know,
high level
crimes of the worst possible nature. But also like a delivery device. Well, I'm not sure I finished it that way, starting it that way. I don't know if I can finish it, but as acclimatization to those crimes. I mean, the word crimes was a bit difficult, because of course the legal system creates crime, but I don't know what else we would call it. Acts of abomination. I mean, like, at a certain point, if you go into this, as I know, at a certain point you just get to actual organized child sex trafficking and murder and torture and snuff and all the rest of it. At a certain point you get to just the dirty, sordid, horrible reality of it, whether it's the mafia or the CIA or both or whatever, right? The question is, at what point it's really impossible to know when you've crossed over from, mm-hmm. you know, the mimetic engineering and the jokes and the lurid, exaggerated mm-hmm. confabulations, when you've crossed over from those into the actual, you know, crimes themselves.
Short of having the actual snuff tapes.
And even then, you wouldn't know.
Right.
Now.
I see. So we're talking about the Illuminati, basically, or we're talking about the Illuminati as the same way Satanism is so laughable to most people that it's a really effective cover story. Because, like you said, if you don't believe in... Most people don't believe in Satan, so therefore they don't believe in Satanists, right?
Yeah, yeah, but you gotta remember that it's only laughable to some people. To other people, it's terrifying.
Sure.
So you could say they're both gullible in totally different ways. The liberal, secular, intelligentsia, or wannabe, you know, people, whatever. I'm going to say people like you and I, but obviously we don't fit into that, but... The people that you and I are more likely to know, who consider themselves too smart to fall for that sort of stuff, they're obviously very gullible, and then the people who wouldn't always be Christians, but a lot of them would be Christians who just think that the whole thing's a satanic conspiracy and they're just terrified by it.
Right. So we've got a problem of ignorance and a problem of arrogance.
Hmm. Yeah, well, they're both, aren't they? Igno-arrogance, as I coined the term. They seem to go very well together. But the polarity, you could even say in our individual psyches, there's that polarity. So it's the sort of atavistic, superstitious part that knows that there are dark forces and therefore...
Sees them everywhere. Yeah,
instinctively... kind of recognizes when it sees them, but it's not in communication with the rational mind that just doesn't believe in them at all and says it's all nonsense. And so there isn't a dialogue. So our rational mind isn't able to inform that more, you know, primal part that, well, yeah, there is, but you need to look at it more closely to see how much is actually supernatural and how much is just manipulation and so on. And by the same token, the rational mind isn't listening to that other side that's saying, wait, there really is something here. You can't just dismiss it.
So now we're talking about an estrangement between the poles of, the increasingly polarized political climate, you know, and the increasingly polarized weather climate. I'm thinking about that because it snowed last week, and you know, fall and spring aren't really seasons; they're transitions between seasons. You know, they're shorter than
right. And
the other seasons, and they seem to be disappearing, right? But I'm just thinking about you know, we have all this gender fluidity and quantum physics has a wave as a particle is a wave as a particle, but yet we're having a lot of trouble reconciling, like you're saying, these sort of basic psychic logic, and I don't want to say superstition, but
intuition.
Intuition, right? Let's do that. Yeah. Intellect and intuition are pretty far estranged at this point.
Yeah, and there's imagination too as well. I mean, like the rational debunkers are saying that all the satanic stuff is just the runaway imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but actually, rationalist debunkers, they're not rational, but they're rationalist, and they're rationalizing. They're using the imagination too. They're just using it to imaginatively dismiss stuff and persuade themselves that they really, you know.
Yeah. And that's back to like the power of certainty that helps you sleep at night, you know. Same way, like atheists atheists and theists experience less anxiety than agnostics, right? Because you know, you'll tell yourself whatever you need to tell yourself to to get rid of uncertainty. Wow, that's all over. We went all over the map with it, or my brain just did.
Yeah, well, because I said I was working on something now that was unrelated to our primary subject, but this is it. This is what we're talking about now. It's the thing that I'm writing about now, and this polarization. So it's not unrelated, I mean, at this deep level, in terms of the split within us, obviously. Mm-hmm. Everything would come out of that, like our whole experience of culture and culture itself would come out of that split.
Do you think you could link, like, the idea of gender being fluid and things like that, could you link that to, like, is that some kind of natural reaction to that polarization, to try and find other ways to find liminality? Like, what, there has to be some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, and there's that paradox, contradiction in the gender thing itself, which is, and people just don't get it. So I just had an email exchange with Peter Watts, you know, the sci-fi author, and it was very brief, but he was saying that, you know, gender does exist, and that, the evidence for it was in blah, 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 some scientific thing. And then he brought up the example of innate homosexuality. So I had to point out to him, whether he got it, received it or not, that gender identification and sexual orientation are inversely related, as in it's one or the other. It can't be both. As in, you're either going to say that some inherent orientation towards the same sex makes you homosexual, or it makes you transgender. Can't be both, right? So the transgender thing is actually at odds with the gender identification thing is at odds with sexual orientation, but they put them together in SOGI, literally, the S-O-G-I. They've literally put them together. But generally, in most people's minds, because they haven't looked into it, they think of them not as the same, but they certainly think of them as complementary and part of an overall gender fluidity, as you call it. But gender identification isn't gender fluidity, it's the opposite. It's saying, I can't let my sense of sexuality be fluid if I feel like, you know, if I have homosexual urges or I want to dress up as the opposite sex, then my identity must be wrong. I need to switch identities.
That's fascinating, because it's almost like, well, the cure for a homosexuality cure, I'm talking about, like, you know, a conservative mindset about homosexuality, ultimately the real cure for that would be to just switch your gender.
Exactly. Yeah, so it only looks like
we could sell that, the conservative.
Well, yeah, good luck. I mean, probably will. I mean, as I say, people are desperate for not even certainty now, because that's not an option, but at least, you know, tolerable uncertainty.
There ain't nobody on me.
it is, that is a kind of a funny, you know, the acrobatics that you would have to go to to figure out a way to sleep better at night. That's a funny idea. It'd be a funny, like, you know, satirical subplot of something.
Well, my equivalent, and this is back to the piece I'm working on now, weirdly enough, seems to be around Hollywood, because I cannot sleep at night, not literally, but in figuratively. It's almost literal, because I listen to these audio commentaries now from DVDs. I mean, I've got a bunch, so I've been listening to them. So, and it's just something I like listening to at night and before sleeping. And but it actually fucks with my head, because whenever I'm listening to David Finchner or Brad Pitt or Martin Scorsese or Robert Altman talking about their movie, at the whole time I'm thinking about what I think I know about Hollywood and how it's this massive, you know, decades-long cultural psyop that intersects with organized crime, intelligence agencies, and systemized, you know, ritual child abuse and the Illuminati, and that these characters I'm listening to, they must be part of it. They're part of it, whether they know it or not, and they must know it a little bit, because everyone else knows about it. So how could they not know about it? Kind of thing. There's got to be some where, and I can't reconcile the two. Like the fan in me that just enjoys the movies and enjoys listening to the creators and just wants to take everything they say at face value, and they seem very sincere and authentic. But then there's the other part, the researcher, that's saying, well, no, you can't actually believe this, any of this, because you know too much to believe it. Right? But I can't reconcile the two. And I think part of it, and I think maybe this is a sort of, this is an overarching subject, maybe with neurodeviance and all the rest of it, but is that it's about lying. It's about when people lie, we can only recognize they're lying if they're like us.
We can only recognize they're lying if they're like us. And so because these people are Hollywood people and they're sort of inherently not like us, right? Is that where you're going?
Well, that's where I'm going. Also, if they were intelligence agents, you wouldn't expect to be able to tell when an operative is lying, because they're trained to lie.
Right.
The very things you'd be looking for are the things they're trained to make sure that you don't see. Right? Mm-hmm. Same with a sociopath, got no conscience, doesn't even recognize the difference between a lie and a truth. Boom. There's none of the tells. It's funny, the thing they say about autists, right? But
yeah, gives so the mask is impenetrable.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I know this rationally, but when it comes to actually human interaction, including with just listening to commentaries, it doesn't kind of help me. Like, I just have to keep reminding myself.
Yeah.
You know? Because instinctively, I'm just believing.
Yeah. And then you have a great deal of dissonance. But I mean, what are they talking about in these commentaries? You know, they're not lying in the commentaries. They're just, you're just questioning the facade of, you know.
No, well, they are lying though. And
well-meaning.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is. First of all, it's that. Well, they seem like, not, you know, he's just laughing and joking, and there's no way, you know, Brad Pitt could possibly be involved in any of this stuff. But if you dig a bit deeper, then yeah, they are lying when you get to it.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes literally and specifically, but otherwise just generally, there's like, if you're pretending to be something you're not, then you're lying.
And maybe because of their programming, they don't even have to pretend, you know, maybe they really believe it for X amount of time, right?
Well, that's the area that I found very difficult to go into, because I've been trying to write this with an eye towards, you know, people who aren't already paranoid.
Right.
So that they can get their heads around it and they can approach it skeptically and then come away thinking, well, oh, maybe I shouldn't be so skeptical about this particular thing. So when you start getting into this whole thing, yes, of fragmentation and, you know, different personalities, alters that don't communicate, which is what part of the book two of Neurodeviant is a lot of it's about that. Maybe that's why I wanted to do it in fiction, actually. Because it's really, really hard to write about coherently or convincingly as nonfiction.
So that you have a character that's a separation, a fragmentation of, I mean, I don't want to, we shouldn't use that. But
yeah, a multiple, a DID character. So, and seeing what his experience is like. And actually, Whitley Strieber was quite helpful in that regard. Cause mm-hmm. Very helpful, I'd say, because he's, well, he describes a lot of the experiences of his own dissociative identity disorder without copying to having it, of course.
Yeah, but probably... it's hard. More open about it than you would expect him to be, right? Right?
Yeah.
Which then you have to figure out, well, what does that mean, right?
Well, it's like the CIA. I mean, they're a lot more open than you'd expect them to be, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't done a lot of research into that. Darren would be somebody more versed in the CIA research.
What was this? I just got this out of the library. I'm not going to read it. I just got it out because it has Hollywood stuff in. It's actually only half a page. But written by a CIA lawyer, it's authorized by the CIA. And, you know, of course, got these reviews on the back going, oh, this is where all the bodies are buried and all the secrets. Why would the CIA agree to this? I'm sure it's lightweight compared to what we're touching on. But still, the CIA, you know, they're authorizing all kinds of disclosures about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And why I suppose it's a bit like you said about the Brave New World, about excess of information, but I think there's more. I think the first thing seems to be that, well, if you can't, in the age of the internet particularly, you can't actually conceal all this or suppress all of it. So at least control the way in which it comes out.
So well, we're never going to be able to withhold everything. So a better strategy would just be increase the disinformation and get as much information out there. I guess we hear this term a lot lately, gaslighting. You know, it could also be that, you know, where maybe you said something about that. Oh, it's that one quote you have in here about we're going to drive people crazy the way, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Ethan Waters, who actually is a denier of ritual abuse. So I was a bit averse to quoting him, but anyway.
What is the quote?
Homogenize the way in which people go mad.
Oh.
We don't realize that by homogenizing our culture, we're just homogenizing the way in which people go mad. Something.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, you know, just the chaos of this kind of postmodern, post-truth, kind of pre-apocalyptic climate, right? Yeah, I mean, I try not to pay attention too much to the pop culture, but it's like, I thought it was last week. I think last week? Last week was, you know, the trending hashtag or whatever. It was mental illness or mental health awareness week.
Mm-hmm.
National Mental Health Awareness Week. I thought it was strange that was that was the time that Kanye West and Trump had their big meeting of the minds, meeting of the people who have lost their minds kind of thing, you know? And it was this big spectacle, and you know, there seems to be like a lot, you know, we're so obsessed with the idea of celebrity meltdown, right? Like that's a whole, I thought Joaquin Phoenix's movie, I'm Still Here, his like mockumentary, that was a really interesting, it didn't really get much, it got really bashed really hard, but nobody really talked about like, well, what, the thing that they really never talked about was that he was making a film about celebrity meltdown, which was like a critique of an industry and a culture that he lost his brother to, you know, like that. And that was, nobody seemed to even talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I saw the film and it wasn't as interesting as the lead up to it, as in when he was having the meltdown. And I did, I came away thinking, oh, and maybe this was intentional ambiguity or not, I don't know, but I came away more inclined to think that he really did have a meltdown and that the movie was damage control.
Oh, wow.
It's all just a prank.
Yeah, huh, that's interesting. I had not thought of that.
But of course, it's in this world, Twilight Zone we're talking about, it's not either or anyway, because
yeah,
it isn't. I mean,
no. We don't even know anymore. Is this meltdown real? I don't even know if my meltdown is real.
I mean, yeah, that is a good psyop, because the next time a celebrity has a meltdown, people will think, I'm not going to be punked again. So they won't take it seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one possible outcome. I don't know. If it got through to enough people.
I think Jim Carrey could play that card, and to some degree has, right? I'm just doing an Andy Kaufman prank here. I'm not really dissociating. You know?
Well, his kidding is about a kid's TV show host. So Jimmy Savile parallels right away. Well, his son gets killed in an accident. That's the sort of backstory. But anyway, the theme and the main story is that he's a Jekyll and Hyde character. It's not clear if he was a sniper in Afghanistan, a CIA assassin, who's got this really dark, violent side, but it's hinted at. It seems like that probably is what they're going to reveal is true. Certainly he's playing on that possibility, but whatever the case, he's going to, you know, he's maintaining this happy-go-lucky kids entertainer facade even in his personal and private life, but circumstances, the pressure's increasing and the cracks are starting to show, and leading us to expect that he's actually got this hidden hide side that's going to come out, you know, really dark destructive behaviors. So it seemed like a pretty canny project for him to do at this particular stage, because, you know, he's become associated now with the, I mean, in his career he was a goofy comedian, so pretty light there, but then post-career enlightened, dissociated Jim Carrey, obviously that was all love and light as well. So now he's sort of consciously addressing that with a story about somebody who is only able to appear love and light because they're repressing this destructive.
Yeah. The shadow and the persona. Yeah. Huh. Well, that's interesting. It's interesting just that even these, that that psyops and MK Ultra, I don't know, becoming sexy, you know, in the culture. Isn't Stranger Things has a MK Ultra plotline now, right? I haven't watched it.
I haven't watched it either, but apparently it's...
Yeah, it's just interesting. I mean, even if we took out, like, the possibility, I have a feeling you'd say probability, that there's some kind of government, there's some kind of agency behind all this entertainment with these things happening. I mean, it's just it's interesting that the entertainment industry would see all this stuff happening on the internet and growing on the internet. And yeah, you know, so much of conspiracy culture is, you know, so imaginative anyway, by its very nature, has to be fill in the blanks, you know? It's almost like they're in the same way that like Hollywood or MTV ripped off art films of the past. It's like, we're going to rip off this thing that's happening on the internet, you know, this conspiracy culture.
Don't know the extent to which internet conspiracy culture wasn't manufactured as well.
Where it began, yeah.
I mean, it began more or less with pre-internet with Mae Brussel. Mm-hmm. And that was very underground.
Yeah.
Well, pretty underground. But I think it stands to reason. I mean, obviously the military had the internet from the 60s or whatever it was, so they had it decades before it went public. Stands to reason that, well, obviously, even it's inevitable, it's undeniable that they would have known ahead of time the internet would be a means for the people to start sharing information specifically about, you know, covert ops and assassinations and all the kind of stuff that they want to keep secret. So then it does stand to reason that they would have planned inundation with disinformation from very early on, and even well, they want it there before anyone else, don't they? They would want the first stuff on the internet
yeah
to be their stuff,
right? then it grows from there. Yeah.
And then it, that's right. I mean, I'm only thinking this just now. So, but that's my feeling, you know, as a researcher myself in alternate perceptions community, more and more, that's why I coined the term second matrix. There's more and more a feeling that there were these, that like the ground was spiked, and so that half the stuff I was finding was, had been planted there, and that it wasn't necessarily because it was false, but because it kind of had these little connecting tissues to narratives that had already been created ahead of time. Mm-hmm. As disinformation narratives. Mm-hmm. And so then I might take a true fact, but I wouldn't realize that it brought with it all these other associations. And I might, if I didn't question or study all of those equally closely, I'd end up regurgitating mm-hmm. narratives created to disinform. As far as Hollywood, I wanted to actually read this because I just read this. I could say it's only one page of the whole book. But among businesses in general, the CIA has long had a special relationship with the entertainment industry, devoting considerable attention to fostering relationships with Hollywood movers and shakers, studio executives, producers, directors, and big name actors. There are officers assigned to this account full time, which is not exactly a dangerous assignment, but one that occasionally produces its own bizarre moments. In my early years at the agency, a veteran CIA liaison with Hollywood first explained it to me this way. These are people who have made a lot of money basically creating make-believe stuff. A lot of them, at least the smarter and more self-aware ones, realize what they do makes them ridiculously rich, but is also ephemeral and meaningless in the larger scheme of things. So they're receptive to helping the CIA in any way they can, probably in equal parts because they are sincerely patriotic and because it gives them a taste of real-life intrigue and excitement. And their power and international celebrity can be valuable. It gives them entree to people and places abroad. Heads of state want to meet and get cozy with them. Their film crews are given free rein everywhere, even in places where the US government doesn't normally have it. And they can be the voice of a US message that will have impact with foreign audiences, so long as the audience doesn't know it is coming from the US government. That would be true of domestic audiences as well, but he doesn't say that. Anyway, so yeah, it's just a paragraph in here and he moves on very quickly. And as I say, this is, you know, authorized by the CIA, so it's hardly deep. You could say it could be bullshit, but I'm pretty sure it's not bullshit. I think it's just, you know, the thin end of a wedge that probably goes back to, you know, the beginning of Hollywood, like we say about the internet. They know that this new film medium is going to take off, or there's a good chance it will, and that these stories are going to have powerful potential to influence people, so better be there at the very start.
Yeah, well, most of the old propaganda, you know, from the 20s, 30s, 40s is really obvious.
Yeah.
It may have even been at the time, you know, may have even felt obvious at the time.
Well, yeah, possibly. I mean, if it's something like recruiting for the war against the Nazis or stuff, they can be obvious and nobody really objects. Now, that's what I point out about 2001, A Space Odyssey or Interstellar, which I didn't actually manage to sit through, but they're both from different periods, very obvious propaganda movies. They're really obvious propaganda for the space budget, whatever you call that, space program. Mm-hmm. But nobody said anything because it's just considered benign anyway. So then if it's benign, it's not propaganda, really.
That's interesting. I just saw an article, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of 2001.
Yeah.
They had a few quotes from, you know, the gist of the article was what impact has it actually had on science? And so there's a number of space people, NASA people talking about seeing the movie as a child. So,
yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is it did have a lasting effect in terms of people's thinking. What was I going to say? That the one I really want to get, I'm trying to get Darren to talk to. I think he's chummy with Matthew Alford, you know him?
He is chummy with him, yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to get somebody to find out some information on, you know, because my big thing was I thought The Imitation Game was so clearly propaganda for how to weaponize autism, you know, how to militarize.
That was the Turing one?
Yeah.
Is that the title? Somehow it doesn't sound right. Anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't, does it? I thought that before, yeah. But it's an interesting, you know, I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so he hasn't been forthcoming. Well, you could do your own. You could just look into the different names involved.
File a FOIA request?
Well, you could go that route. I haven't done that ever, and I thought about it.
You don't want to get on a list.
I'm just too lazy, really. I suppose I ought to if I'm becoming more concern with reaching skeptics, but anyway, even just using Google or whatever, a search engine, unfortunately it does tend to have to be Google if you want to get the best results. For different players, you can dig out quite a lot about their associations. I mean, you have to already have a paranoid mindset to recognize the clues, which then of course presents the problem that when you want to share them, you've got to, you know, take off your paranoid hat and recontextualize them in a way that isn't paranoid, if you see what I mean. Like, you can't assume that other people are going to see these same links, and just that's why it's nice to find quotes like I just read to you, because it's just like, well, there it is in black and white, folks. And yeah, and that's not only good to make a point, but it's also good to illustrate a more general point, which is that things that are historically established are still seen as conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's just a matter of history, but it hasn't seeped right into the,
sure,
you know, the collective awareness. I don't know about Hollywood CIA. It feels as though that's pretty widespread now, but still, I mean, you could easily have a conversation with someone and they'd call you a conspiracy theorist for saying that. Sure. I think.
The part about that quote that struck me was the idea of being attracted to the kind of intrigue and excitement of that, of working with the CIA, because it's almost like, you know, movie people who want their lives to be like movies, you know.
Exactly, yeah. Well, they play CIA agents and then they get to join the CIA. Right. Or vice versa, of course.
I was going to ask you, do you feel like, as we were talking about, like Philip K. Dick in that interview, he talks about really being aware that he had, I think you called it a weak ego, you know, like, just the idea that he could be sitting across from somebody and that person could just tell him anything.
Mm-hmm.
He could be converted. He could, you know, believe it. And I think, like, and, you know, he connects that to Martian time slip, where one person's, you know, by change, one person's world takes over another person to live in somebody else's world. Do you feel like you have a weak ego?
Well, that in that regard, yeah, if it's being susceptible to other people's influence, absolutely, totally. I think I've demonstrated it.
Yeah,
many
you mean
times, huh?
In terms of like you were in a cult at some point.
Yeah, the John DeRuiter thing, even the Whitley Strieber thing, Castaneda.
Right.
Yeah, a number of times that I've, you know, fully taken something on board, and there is this method acting thing. There is this part of me that's saying, well, it doesn't believe my own beliefs.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that, I mean, that part has got more developed and more operational, I'd say. my capacity to believe or my susceptibility hasn't necessarily diminished. It's just now back to this two parts of the psyche, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the rational part that can intervene and say, well, okay, yes, you can feel this way, but just don't stop testing and checking and analyzing what you're feeling and comparing, you know, to the facts and comparing your perceptions to the facts, reality checking the whole time. That part's become more, it's either become more active or there's more of a flowing dialogue between the two, because it might well have been active before, but only, you know, selective skepticism.
Sure. That's like the F. Scott Fitzgerald line in my book, you know, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still function, you know? It's
like that. Yeah.
The opposite of dissonance.
Right, to withstand cognitive dissonance and to tolerate ambiguity. And Keats said something similar about negative capability, he called it. I have to wonder, though, as you know, how much of that is, that's part of psychological operations as well.
Yeah, you have to hold that in mind with there's yet another layer of
but yeah, back to susceptibility. What was I going to say about that? I was going to say something else. Impressionability. Oh yeah, that relates to what I was saying about lying. Those of us who have weak central cohesion or are neurodiverse or whatever it is, whatever the basis is of it, perhaps, you know, trauma related to, have a hard time recognizing when we're being tricked. And that, I mean, that is a known characteristic of autism, I recognize in myself. If you joke with an autistic or an Aspergerian or both, they often won't realize that you're joking. Because there's a neurotypical way of joking, which is basically you just say the thing as if it was serious, but
yeah,
it's not. Like, yeah. I remember a woman I was staying with when I was a kid saying, "You can tuck me in now." I was about 15 at the time. And I just went over to tuck her in. But she was just, it was just a joke. It's just like, "Oh, you're in the room when I'm going to bed. You could tuck me in." Like, she wasn't a kid. She didn't want to be tucked in. But all I heard was, "You can tuck me in now." So I went over to tuck her in. That literal mindedness, right? So lying, I mean, well, irony is the opposite of literal.
Right.
So you got the jokes of Jimmy Savile and Co, my brother. Well, that, you know, ironic detachment, but also lying, of course, is the opposite of literal, because you're saying one thing, but it's not true. Opposite, it's not that you mean the opposite, because you're meaning to deceive, but you're saying one thing and knowing that it's the opposite of true.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely something that I've struggled with as well. Not necessarily like the inability to recognize irony, but like I just find that I'm impressionable and mirroring of whoever I'm talking to. And I remember when I was real young, like when I was a teenager, reading that was a symptom of borderline personality disorder. And I got really afraid because I thought that I might be borderline personality disorder. That was the symptom that was most. And I think it's what's so frustrating about it is because then, to some degree, you don't have an authentic sense of self, you know. But when I remember when I first listened to that Philip Dick interview and hearing him say that, like some kind of relief, you know.
Yeah.
It could be used to my advantage, you know.
Well, in terms of being a writer, you can see how it would be a big advantage, because you
can, yeah.
get into the minds of your characters.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's nonfiction, you can entertain a lot of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing. It's a weird sort of contradiction, because what can sometimes be my gullibility is also my flexibility and my openness to anything. Like I don't encounter many people in all my conversations who seem to be as able to consider the possibilities as I can. So although I will take a position, if I'm talking to somebody who's a fan of David Icke, I'll be very skeptical of reptilians. But if I'm talking to somebody who thinks David Icke's full of shit and thinks that it's laughable, the reptilians, mm-hmm. then I will argue for the reptilians, right? But it's not just a negative identity thing. It's that it's possible for me to span that spectrum without too much trouble. I can see that it could be total bullshit. It's a literalization of something, you know, that's much more archetypal or psychological. But I can also say, well, there might be shape-shifting reptilian entity. I mean, you do the same in Notes on several occasions. You know that you don't know.
Yeah, and I didn't connect quite, you know, like in your book, you have this, you sort of realized like, you're talking about more of that subjective experience of and the neurodiversity. Of, you know, either we recognize that our interpreting mind self is a completely unreliable narrator of a fictional narrative, or we admit that everything we think we know is wrong. Either way, we are up Invisible Creek without an imaginary paddle. Without an imaginary paddle.
Without an imaginary, you could at least have an imaginary.
Right. Wow. Yeah, and you know, like I had never like that converging of kind of, you know, like, all that growing trend of neurodiversity and the kind of cultural postmodern, you know, subjective reality, right? It's growing more and more. I'd never made that connection about that convergence of how we're just kind of, you know, because now, like, you know, now the post-true buzzword, you know, it's all, and kind of, you know, I notice every so often there'll be some internet meme where it's either a dress that some people see as blue or some people see as gold, or some kind of audio test that some people hear as saying this, but others hear as saying this, you know, right. It's this thing kind of growing and more, yeah. And then that's like, and then, you know, like things like white nationalism, it's like, that's the attempt to find solid ground, to find something real to stand on in the chaos of nothing being real and everything being subjective, trying to find an objective truth, albeit not a very,
well, I think it's partly, it's negative identity syndrome again, because it's partly defined. I mean, the choice of what to identify as ground is partially or largely defined by what is considered
quicksand.
Yeah, I guess so. That would be a nice way to finish that, stay in the metaphor. It's considered, well, dangerous ground anyway, by the fact it's considered dangerous or threatening. You're not supposed to go there. You're not supposed to go to racial realism or sexual realism or what have you. Not that I'm advocating white nationalism, but
the more forbidden the thing is, the more some people see that as a sign that that's the thing, you know?
Yeah, because the culture itself is becoming so destabilized and destabilizing that it kind of makes a certain sort of sense intuitively that the things that the culture is prohibiting must be the real things.
Yeah.
but it's no, it doesn't. It doesn't seem to work, because it's, I mean, it's like controlled opposition, maybe in a more subtle way, but it seems as though the point of tolerating ambiguity and holding two opposing thoughts in mind at the same time and so on is about, in the words of Tyler Durden here, come to my mind rather disturbingly, you know, letting everything that doesn't matter truly slide.
Mm-hmm.
Like actually recognizing that we know so little that there isn't much we can really get behind,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in terms of what we're going to take seriously enough to fight for, let's say. But now everybody's fighting for everything. It's just, you know, it's like the stakes are so much higher. Like the more liminal it gets, the more people feel that
every battle,
you've got to take a stand in every battle, yeah, is Armageddon.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen anymore. I won't listen anymore.
So I've released this week's podcast in two different versions. That's the full 2 hour plus version, which is in the main stream for RSS followers and iTunes and whatnot. But I've also broken it into two parts, which you can find within the text of the show notes. These are ongoing conversations that Gib and I are having, also with Calvin briefly, around the subject of the Kubricon and Neurodeviance, and I'll continue to air them or parts of them whenever I don't have a podcast, perhaps, if you're lucky. I'd like to thank my donators again this week for your support, to let you know that Vice of Kings will be out in January of 2019, so you can pre-order that now. Find a link at my website. Also, Prisoner Infinity, Seen and Not Seen, the other two installments of the Cultural Engineering Trinity. Order them if you haven't read them. And let me know what you think. Any requests you have for this podcast, or any other feedback for one more week. This is Jason Horsley at The Liminalist, the podcast between
these words. These words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice.